Okay, so we're going to talk about mantle structure now. We're going to look at what seismic imaging can tell us in the mantle, and we're going to look at the structure at places where we think plumes might arise or they might not arise. So first of all, we're going to talk about what the mantle is made of and how it varies from place to place. Obviously, when you're dealing with melting anomalies, places which are unusual in their volcanic behaviour, what we're interested in is variations. Why is there a volcano here and not there? A very eminent professor who has recently passed away, unfortunately, once said, the real question to ask is, why aren't there volcanoes everywhere? How does the mantle move and convect, and what experiments can we stage to find these things out? Well, that's not as easy as you might think. We can look at the structure of the mantle, but that tells us nothing about how stuff is moving down there. Many people forget that. So there are four ways of approaching it. The first is the most popular approach. You just speculate, hand wave, and you draw little cartoons. We can do theoretical modelling. This is another way forward. We can assume things about the rock physics, the rock density, the phase, various other parameters. We can program this up in a computer, we can set it going, and we can see how our numerical system works. This is also a popular method, and many people place a great deal of store on this and look to these experiments to verify approach number one. Okay, but the trouble is, this theoretical modelling is only as good as the parameters you put in. And so far, no numerical model of the Earth has been able to simulate plate tectonics. So if we can't simulate the very first order thing that we're most confident about, then clearly we have to consider the results of theoretical modelling in context. Just because somebody's shown that X happens in a theoretical model, it doesn't mean that it happens in the Earth. Would you stop talking at the back? We can make predictions. This is what we ought to be doing. So number three, we're getting down to what we should be doing. Make predictions and test them by observations. That's what we should be doing. We should be making predictions and testing them with observations. We should not be going out and making observations, dreaming up a model that fits the observations and saying this is what must be happening. That is not what we do. Well, it's what we do, but it's not what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be making forward predictions on our models and then going out and testing those. I've just come back from a conference in Baltimore, and an eminent colleague of mine said to me, he said, we were talking about student projects, and he said, the sort of project that students should go for are the ones that address important questions. And that many students, many research scientists, many staff, many professors also, like to play it a bit safe and to do things that they're pretty sure are doable. They make a small increment on what we know, and you can be fairly certain of getting your paper published without very much trouble. But if you really want to do something important, you have to go after a problem that's important. And you have to try to make a big leap forward. Okay? So 9 times out of 10, you may fail. But once in a while, you can really win the jackpot, scientifically speaking. Looking inside the mantle, that's essentially seismology. Seismology is the only method, so the first approximation, that can tell us specifically about the structure in specific regions of the Earth. Okay, there are one or two other approaches that we can take that can give us a broad view of things, but seismology, you can think of seismology as a laser, if you like, where you can target little points in the Earth and you can find out about those points that you wish to target. Of course, there are methods like gravity surveying and resistivity, where you put a lot of sensors out on the ground and you measure existing fields within the Earth. But those methods can only show you a broad picture of what lies beneath, and there's a big ambiguity problem. With gravity surveying, for example, you can measure the Earth's gravity field, and you can come up with an infinite number of different models that will fit the gravity field, theoretically. Okay? In the case of seismology, you can't actually target little places. People do chemical measurements, of course. course, look at the composition of lavas and speculate about what's come from the upper mantle, what's come from the transition zone, what's coming from the lower mantle. But you cannot directly detect that using geochemistry. Okay. Geochemistry cannot tell you the depth or the place from which a source rock has come. Of course, if you look at a lava, say, that's erupted in Hawaii, we kind of know where that lava's come from. It's come from a magma chamber, which we can potentially image. But we don't know where the source rock has come from. This is the thing that geochemists want to know. They take a chunk of lava from Iceland or Hawaii or somewhere like that, and they want to know where the source rock came from, where the rock originally came from that melted out of. Okay? Did it come from shallow depths? Did it come from some inhomogeneity in the upper mantle? Or did it come from the lower mantle or the core mantle boundary? And geochemistry cannot tell you that without making a lot of assumptions which are not actually testable. Whole mantle tomography, this is what seismologists do. So here we're looking at a rather cute portrayal of some whole mantle tomography results. So here we've got obviously a map of the Earth in the middle. And what we're looking at here is the mantle, so this is the core mantle boundary, if you like, in these coloured rings. This is the core mantle boundary, and this is the surface. And the little globe inside is showing you where the 360-degree cross-section was drawn. And all of these are the same. So this is lesson number one, and it's something my group has been focusing on quite a lot just recently, that we have a real problem with seismic tomography results and models of cross-sections in that repeatability is poor. The results for the same region from different groups using different data sets or very similar data sets are different. And so this was published in 2001. This came to people's attention a long time ago. So here, for example, we're looking under North America. This is North America here. America. So if you just look at this blue thing here, scientists think that under North America there's a subducted slab which has completely disappeared. Okay, so some 15 million years ago or so, a spreading ridge subducted beneath California. And so a whole subducted slab went under there. Okay, and the plate boundary was destroyed, and the plate boundary in California turned into a strike slip fault, the San Andreas Fault. But 15 million years ago, this slab disappeared. So underneath North America, there should be a kind of abandoned slab. And this is known as the Farallon Slab. So people are interested in this area here to see if you can spot this slab. So they're looking for blue things, okay, high wave speed. So if you take a look at this high wave speed region here, between these different models, here's one that looks pretty slab-like. This looks pretty slab-like. This one's kind of missing in the upper mantle. These don't really look very slab-like. People have tried to see if they can find this slab. Quite an interesting problem. Recently, a huge network has been deployed right across North America, so we've got much more detail about the upper mantle here. And you can sort of see it here in these results, and it's not at all clear where it goes. People have also pointed out that, okay, we've got a blue thing here, but this has got an absolutely ginormous volume. Does this volume correspond to the volume of stuff that we think has been subducted? I'm not aware that anybody has done that calculation. It's an interesting project for somebody. Okay, what causes seismic velocity to vary? Basically four themes here. Composition. When we're talking about the mantle, this boils down to the MgFe proportions in olivine in the mantle. State, whether there's partial melt or not. Temperature and mineral phase. So let's take a look at these. Here we're looking at the P wave velocity as a function of Mg over Mg plus Fe percent. So this is basically telling you how porceritic and phaletic mantle olivine is. And as you can see, if we go from 100% Mg down to about 70 frequency drops from about 8 kilometers per second down to about 7.2. So what percentage is that, somebody? If you start off 8 and you drop it to 7.2, what percentage velocity reduction is that? 10%, that's right. So if you change the composition, the Mg and the Fe in olivine by a sort of kind of reasonable amount that could actually physically occur, nothing too extreme, then you can vary the velocity by about 10%. Here we're looking at an example of what happens if you have partial melt. So here we're looking at depth from 0 kilometers down to the center of the Earth. And here we've got velocity. And I'll just draw your attention to the speed of S waves, shear waves, at the surface. They're 4 point something or other, and it rapidly rises through the transition zone to about 6. It's reached 7 by the base of the mantle. And what happens to it below the base of the mantle? Yes, and so what happens to Vs just below the core mantle boundary? Drops to 0, yes? Why is that? Core is liquid. I brought some goodies back from this conference, so I'll hand a few of these out for people to get right answers, shall I? Who was it who said 10% back there? Who was it, Ryan? Pass that back to Ryan. And your eyesight's good. The geological time scale and 1 point time. Okay, so in a complete liquid there are no shear waves. So if you have a material in the mantle where you've got, say, 1% of melt, 2% of melt, you will get a lowering of the S wave velocity, and P in fact, but it won't actually completely disappear. So this is what we're looking at. Let me see, this line here is an average model for the Earth, EASP 91. This one here. Look better in colour, wouldn't it? And here we're looking at some specific seismic structures under specific regions. So here we have the North Atlantic. The velocity jumps here at the Moho and down to about 100 kilometres depth. Okay, this goes from 0 to 700 kilometres. From the Moho downwards, it's kind of roughly constant, not really, but this is just an approximation. But then when you get down to about 90 kilometres, the S wave velocity drops, and we have what's known as the low velocity zone. Immediately underneath Iceland, this is what the picture looks like. There's an even more pronounced low velocity zone here. And this dotted line here, this is for the AFAR region. There's a low velocity line there too. So in these places, the S-wave velocity is dropping by about 10%. And we think this is due to partial melt. And we think that this is the asthenosphere. And we think that this is what is allowing tectonic plates to move. There's this layer of highly, you know, it's got a low viscosity, this stuff can flow, and the plates are sliding on this region that's got a percentage of partial melt, which may be 1% or 2%. People have made various estimates. I think I grabbed this from a paper which claimed there was 10% melt in the low velocity zone under Iceland. So this is a little summary. I think I may have shown this last week. A little bit of revision material here. Here we have the seismic phase, P waves and S waves. Per 1% of partial melt, okay, VP will drop by 2 to 3%, and VS will drop by 3 to 10%. So one potential way of finding if there's partial melt somewhere is to look and see if you get a huge reduction in VS and just a relatively small reduction in VP. Composition, if you reduce Mg over Mg plus Fe by about 10%, you get a reduction in Vp of 7%, and you get a reduction of in Vs of about 12%. These are quite big numbers. If you increase the temperature by 100 degrees, you get a decrease in Vp of 1% and a decrease in Vs of about 1.5. So you can see that we've got three, I haven't talked about mineralogical phase changes, but we've got three factors here which can all affect wave speed, and some of them affect wave speed strongly and others less strongly, and in fact temperature is the weakest effect. So seismology is not a thermometer. It's not a thermometer because when we map seismic wave speed, that's what we're mapping. We're mapping seismic wave speed. We're not mapping temperature, we're not mapping composition, we're not mapping partial melt. We're mapping seismic wave speed. And there are more things varying. There are at least three things here which are varying, okay, which can affect seismic wave speed. And of course, you typically only have two, you know, if you're lucky, you'll have VP and VS. You've only got two data, you've got three unknowns. Often you just have VS. So here's an example, the super plumes, so-called, nicknamed. If you look at the seismic structure at the core mantle boundary, you see something like this. Okay, you see two enormous regions here of low VS, low shear wave speed. One here, one is underneath the Pacific here, and one is underneath the South Atlantic, and it sort of merges over to Africa. So this is at 2,500 kilometres depth, and this is at the CMB at 2,850. So the Earth is almost brought one of my dumbbells in to show you. The Earth is a little bit like a dumbbell. If you imagine you know, a grapefruit or something like that in the middle, that's the core, and sitting on the core are two sort of lumps, if you like, which are these red things. Which have got low shear wave velocity. So the Earth is a little bit like a dumbbell with a kind of ball in the middle, if you like, and these two things sitting on the edge. And these are low wave speed, and the stuff round about, okay, kind of donut, is high wave speed. You know, what we're looking at here, this is 360 degrees, so this is like the globe, which is being opened up, just flattened on a piece of paper. So this blue band here, this is going the circumference of the Earth. This is like 180 degrees around the Earth. So this is a repeatable result between all models. We're more or less completely confident that these things exist. And people are sort of arguing a bit about what they are, and how they're affecting mantle convection, and what their detailed structure is. Those things are not yet sorted out. They're still, you know, it's different from study to study. But the fact that these things exist, that's a robust result. When they were first discovered, people basically said, "Ooh, you know, they're red, so they must be hot." Okay, and this model emerged that they were ginormous plumes like this. It was known that these things do not poke up more than a few hundred kilometres. Okay, they may be sort of 500-600 kilometres high, and then they disappear. And it was suggested that they're in fact huge mantle plumes like this, and that little plumes spawn off their top. So this was the very first model that came out. It was quite quickly discovered that the places that people have suggested are mantle plumes are not over the middle of these things, they're actually sort of round the edges. And furthermore, these red things are not hot. So this, you know, which was, it was just a conclusion that somebody jumped to, quickly published, and it turned out that both the assumptions were wrong. First of all, we know they're not hot, because we can tell this because they're so large. You very, very rarely can look at a seismic model and see the blue and the red and determine whether it's temperature, composition, or melt. It's extremely rare that you can do this, because how could you do it? There's no method. But because these things are very large, it was possible to use what's known as normal modes, which are excited in the Earth by gigantic earthquakes. It's possible to use these to get the density of these things. So on the left here, we've got the S wave speed from this normal mode experiment, and on the right, we've got the density. So the density, you can see here we've got this red blob here, and here we've got blue here, which is high density. And we've got red here under Africa, and under the South Atlantic, and there you've got blue again. So these big red things are in fact dense, and so they're not hot. If they were hot, they would have a low density. So they were then termed large, low shear velocity provinces, or LLSVPs. And that was a good move, because we were immediately moving on to call something by what it is, by what we know. Okay. So we know they're large, we know the shear wave velocity is low, and we know it's a region inside the Earth. So this name is what the thing actually is. Whereas if you call them superplumes, you're immediately assuming A, that they're hot, and B, that they're rising. And geological terminology does tend to suffer a little bit about like this, that people see something, they draw a conclusion about what it is, a cryptovolcanic structure or something like that, and they'll give it a name which basically encapsulates what their guess is as to what it is. Okay, so that's not a good thing to do. You know, we should name something by what we know it is, and not by some speculative interpretation which 5 minutes later is going to be proved wrong. They were also nicknamed by a colleague of mine, super piles, because this colleague suggested that if they're dense, they're sitting there on the Earth's core, then they're not going to be moving and convecting. They're just kind of squatting there like toads on lily pads. So he called them piles. And our official website, Cartoonist, made a little bit of fun of this by drawing this diagram here. E.J. Garnero, Doctor of Geoproctology. You have been diagnosed with piles. This was published in a book that I edited. And before I thought, well, you know, I'm going to run this by E.J. Garnero first. So I sent it to him and said, would you be offended if this was published? And he emailed back saying, this is hilarious. I'm going to use it in my teaching. So I thought, well, if you're going to use it in your teaching, I'll use it in my teaching too. But anyway, just popping back to this, just to remind you that a change in Mg plus Fe, this is probably what's going on. These piles have got more iron than other regions of the mantle. Of course, the question is, why? What are they? What are they doing there? Nobody knows what these things are or why they're there, or whether they're changing, or whether they're a permanent feature of the Earth's mantle. Okay, let's look at mineral phase changes. These kick in when pressure increases. So if we're looking laterally, so you're trying to map Europe, see if there are any plumes under it, or something like that, you're not going to be too worried about mineralogical phase changes, because these occur when pressure changes, not when you go laterally. Okay, and we see them most prominently at the core mantle boundary and the transition zone. So the CMB, first of all, this is quite a recent finding. It was discovered that at a particular depth and temperature, perovskite, which is the phase of olivine for most of the mantle, changes to a denser phase called post-perovskite. So this was just discovered in 2004. That if you go deep down, almost as far as the CMB, but not quite, then there's a sudden mineralogical phase change. So this is quite convenient, because we're interested in the core mantle boundary. So if there's some marker horizon, which is a horizon of constant PT, constant pressure and temperature, we can map that out around the whole core mantle boundary. We're basically making a map of a constant pressure-temperature boundary around the whole core mantle boundary. So this was discovered simultaneously by a Japanese group and a Swiss group, simultaneously published in Science and Nature. We're finished there. Okay, a little bit of information about it. It occurs at about 2,600 kilometres. It occurs at a temperature of about 2,500 K. So this is the lowermost few hundred kilometres of the mantle. It's got a positive Clapeyron slope. Have you been taught about Clapeyron slopes? Did you? group who shows his equipment and explains how it works. So I'm not going to shout because, of course, it's in Japanese, and you won't be able to read the subtitles here. But if you watch it on your own laptops, you'll be able to read the subtitles. So it's quite interesting. What scientists have done is to map this phase change. So this phase change equates to a sudden increase in wave speed. So there's a velocity discontinuity there, and people have mapped it around the world here to look for, basically, it's like mapping an isotherm. We know the pressure is constant down at, say, 2,500 kilometers depth, so if the height of this phase change varies, then it's a pretty good bet that that's because the temperature is varying. Some authors have tried to correlate regions of low VS at the core mantle boundary with melting anomalies, e.g. Iceland. So people will study the core mantle boundary, they'll say, aha, there's a patch here which we think is hot, and they'll look at the surface and say, where is the nearest hot spot? And they'll speculate that this hot patch at the CMB is the base of a plume that may be fueling the hot spot. So one thing you've got to do this afternoon, or whenever you get around to it, is to search the literature for your particular hotspot to see what seismic reports there are about the structure down at the core mantle boundary. It's very rare that a conduit from the core mantle boundary all the way up to the top is reported. And when it's reported, it tends not to be repeatable. There's no place on Earth, really, where more than one group has said, there's a conduit down here, from here to the core mantle boundary. There have been a number of cases where people have claimed this to be true, but there's no consensus about it like there is the LLSDPs. And one person will say there's a conduit here, and 5 minutes later somebody has published a paper saying, I don't see it in my data, or, you know, these workers made such and such a mistake, you know, it's not resolved, something like that. So there's no conduit anywhere which is repeatably imaged. But people have, from time to time, reported these things in individual papers, and people have also looked for places at the core mantle boundary which are hot, and they say, you know, there's a hot spot up here, and they have suggested that these two things may be joined. There's a problem with seeing conduits because they're postulated to be quite narrow. This is the problem. Morgan's hypothesis, he postulates that they're maybe 100 kilometres across, maybe 300 kilometres across, and that's actually not resolvable. Even in the best seismology, you cannot see something which is a couple of hundred kilometres across in the lower mantle. So, that's what the lower mantle looks like. There's a sudden jump there. So let's move on swiftly to the transition zone. Okay, it's bounded by seismic discontinuities at 410 kilometres and 650 kilometres. So this is a 410 discontinuity, this is a 650 discontinuity. So everybody should remember those two numbers, those are very important numbers. The top of the transition zone is at 410, the bottom is at 650. So if an exam question is asked in this module or another module that involves the transition zone, you'll remember that it's bounded by seismic discontinuities at 410 and 650. The eminent scientist that I mentioned to you before, who passed away just recently, I've just come back from this conference where I recently edited a book in his honour. His name was Don Anderson. Okay, so I'll put a few of these out for you. And this book was produced in his honour. I'll tell you a little bit about him later. He was an extremely interesting character. He was diagnosed with terminal esophageal cancer. Let's see, April the 6th of last year, and his first thought was, when he was told he had weeks or months to live, his first thought was, oh my God, I've got all these unfinished manuscripts, how am I going to get them published in this time? So he started emailing all his colleagues written manuscript. Can you help me finish this? And he sent about 10 of these out. Okay, so I inherited one about Yellowstone, and literally. And anyway, so everybody rallied around him. He was a very, very eminent scientist. So perhaps he was the greatest geophysicist of his time. And so, and he passed away in December of last year. But when I realised what he was doing, I thought, you know, his work is so controversial, it's really difficult to get published, and many of his colleagues don't realise what they're taking on, so we've got to have a special volume for these things. So I edited a special volume where we published all these papers, which are his half-finished manuscripts, which were finished up by his graduate students, his ex-graduate students, some of whom came out of retirement to do the job, and the colleagues like myself. So my Yellowstone paper is in there, in case the Yellowstone group is interested. But anyway, this scientist, it was him that discovered the 410 and the 650 discontinuity. When he was working in his younger days, nobody knew what was inside the Earth, and seismology was just beginning to be a subject. And it was him that discovered this. It was him that proposed there was this transition zone. It was him that wondered why there were these seismic discontinuities. And so he changed subject and moved into mineral physics and started recruiting a lot of mineral physics graduate students who were doing unbelievably dangerous experiments in high pressure labs without any safety equipment. And he explained these seismic discontinuities as mineralogical phase changes. And then he wondered why it was occurring, why other things were happening, and so he moved into geochemistry. And this is why his book is called The Interdisciplinary Earth, because he worked across all disciplines of geophysics and geochemistry. Quite an amazingly broad person. So this is what the transition zone looks like, we think, now. The top is at 410, there's some kind of discontinuity in the middle of it also, and the bottom is at 650. And the reason they exist is because of olivine. So olivine is in the form of olivine, above 410. Just below 410, the pressure increases to a degree, to an amount that olivine becomes a denser phase, and it exists in the phase of Wadsleyite. Below about 500 or so, it moves to a denser phase still, which is called ringwoodite, and at 650 it exists as perovskite and magnesio-woustite, and then way down the core mantle boundary, post-perovskite. So this is how we look at what depths these things occur at. So here we have a schematic graph showing temperature as a function of depth, and here we have 410 and 650. Okay, so this black line, let's just say that that's just average temperature. So if the mantle's an average temperature, you know, average geotherm, obviously it gets warmer as you go further down. When you get down to 410, you'll reach the temperature and pressure under normal conditions where the first mineralogical phase change will occur at 410. And if you go down at this particular normal geotherm, it will occur at 650. Now, supposing you're in a region where the mantle is colder, for example, in a subducting slab. Okay, we've got a geotherm something like this. So this is a positive slope. And we call this a positive slope, we call this a negative slope. This is the Clausius-Clapeyron slope for 410, and this is the Clausius-Clapeyron slope for 650. Okay, so supposing we've got our slab coming down, and it reaches this point here, because it's colder, it will pop to the denser phase at 400 kilometres, a little bit shallower. And because it's now all of a sudden denser, this is going to encourage it to sink even faster and go straight through 410 and carry on down. Okay, so here's our slab carrying on down here. When it gets to 650, okay, this slope is negative. So when it gets down to 650, because it's colder, it hasn't yet got to a point where it can pop to after the denser phase. It has to get down to, say, 660 before it can pop to the denser phase. So here it is at 650, it's trying to poke its way into dense material, and it cannot achieve that density by changing to the denser phase. So this will tend to hinder this slab going down, and this slab will tend to turn and creep along the 650 discontinuity. And there are many seismic images which show some slabs doing that. If we think of a hot riser, for example, a mantle plume is hotter, okay? So the mantle plume won't be along this blue line here, the mantle plume will be along this red line, higher temperature. So the mantle plume comes up here, it's in the denser phase, it's rising up. It reaches 650, and it wants to pop to the lighter phase, because the stuff above 650, the stuff that's just residing here at normal temperature, this is in a less dense phase. But the poor old mantle plume has come up to 650, and because it's hotter, it's in the denser phase, and it can't pop to the less dense phase until it gets to, say, 640. So the plume is stuck down here, and it can't push its way up into the less dense stuff because it can't change its own density. So a plume will spread out under 650. If, however, you have a hot riser or a plume that's managed to break through, and it's in the transition zone here, okay, it's rising up here, it comes up to this second mineralogical phase change, and when it reaches, say, 420, because it's hotter, it can change to the less dense phase immediately at 420. But less dense here, so this encourages it to continue on up. So the nature of the Clausius Clapeyron slope at 410 will encourage convection. Slabs will easily punch through 410. Hot risers will easily rise up. But at 650 will hinder convection. Cold slabs going down will be hindered by the phase change at 650, and they will either not be able to break through, or they will break through with some difficulty. And the same for hot risers. Hot riser is likely to only partially come through. And there's quite a big discussion amongst scientists depending on the slope of this line here. If you have a very steep slope, you can turn off whole mantle convection. If the slope is quite gentle, then there may be some, it may hinder convection, but it doesn't stop it completely. Stuff can pass on up and down. So it's quite critical exactly what this slope of that line is, as to whether we have whole mantle convection or whether we have separate convection in the upper mantle and the lower mantle. Okay, we've seen this before. This is the temperature profile average of the Earth. And it's interesting to note, because of this negative slope, you think about this afterwards, there's actually a temperature inversion at 650. The temperature below 650 might be 100 or 200 degrees cooler than above 650. This is an endothermic phase change, so any material passing through 650, any material passing down, say, beneath 650, will absorb heat, and therefore its temperature will be lower. This phase change is endothermic. The phase change needs heat for it to occur, so it will draw this heat from its surroundings, and the temperature will drop. The depth of these phase changes also varies with composition. So here we're looking at the 410 discontinuity. These are different experiments, but you can see if we vary the amount of magnesium in the material, so here we have 100% magnesium and here we're becoming more phaolitic, there's more iron in it, then let me see, pressure goes downwards, so as it becomes more iron rich, the pressure at which the phase change occurs reduces, so the phase change occurs higher up. Thank you. look at when you start looking at your seismological evidence, you know, in the region of your hotspots, is what does the transition zone look like? If the transition zone, if the 410 bulges up like this, if the 410 is unusually shallow, this could be due to high iron content, wet conditions, or low temperature. So again, you know, these three factors which affect these things. In the case of high temperature, if you have the 410 dropping down like this, so you'd have a thin transition zone, this could be due to high magnesium, dry conditions, or high temperature. I'll put a little question mark here because we now realise that there are more phase changes here than just the one in olivine, also phase changes in other minerals, and this complicates the picture a little bit here. So initially it was assumed that under these conditions here, high magnesium, dry and high temperature, 650 would dome up, and we dome down here under the opposite conditions, but there's a little bit of uncertainty in that now because of other mineralogical phase changes. So people run experiments of this sort here, just quickly wrapping up here. People look at exotic phases, if you like. They look at, for example, this is an S wave bouncing off the surface, this is an S wave bouncing off 410, and this is an S wave bouncing off 660, and people look to see what the time difference between, say, this phase and this phase is, and they use that to get the thickness of the transition zone. So this is the kind of thing that you're looking at. This is a wave that's travelled along, it's bounced off 660 and then it's gone to its seismic station. And this is a 440 one. So this is a measured earthquake. This is a theoretical seismograph. So here we have this wiggle here. This is the 660 bounce. This is the 410 bounce. And basically what you're doing is measuring the time between these bounces. But these waves are very long period. This is 100 seconds here. You can see they're very long period. So you know, where this starts is a little bit unsure. What you have to do is to take lots and lots of these seismograms and stack them. So people stack hundreds of these seismograms in order to sharpen up the data so they can make a more accurate measurement. Because we're trying to look for variations of just 5 kilometres in the depth of some of these discontinuities. And this is a map of transition zone thickness. So the transition zone is relatively thin through most of the Pacific. It tends to be thicker underneath the continents. There's not an absolute one-to-one correlation. It's thin over here, for example. So you know, it varies globally as well as on a smaller scale. So one thing you want to be doing for your hotspots is to look to see if there are any papers out there talking about transition zone thickness under your hotspot. This has been done for Iceland, it's been done for Galapagos, it's been done for Hawaii, so this is quite a popular method. Okay, summary. Bottom of the transition zone is a significant barrier to convection, but we don't know how strong. Some people think it's 100%, other people think it doesn't make much difference. There's no one-to-one correspondence between wave speeds or transition zone topography and physical properties. And seismology tells us seismic structure. But if anybody flashes up a seismology picture and says, you can see from this that it's hot in this region or cold in this region, and that's wrong. And if they flash up a topography picture and they say, this shows that there's upward convection or downward convection here, that's wrong too. So what you're looking at is seismic wave speed, and it's ambiguous how you interpret it. Okay, let's have a break then, and 5 minutes past on my watch, we'll reconvene.